I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Just a few weeks ago on the CBC's Nature of Things, you might have seen the film Maureen Palmer made that looked at the journey Michael Pond made from having a family and successful counseling practice in Penticton to ending up in Vancouver's downtown east side alone looking for a drink. The film is based on the new book Wasted, an alcoholic therapist's fight for recovery in a flawed treatment system. It's a new edition of a book we talked about on this program nearly 2 years ago, The Couch of Willingness. Both Mike and Maureen join me now to talk about what they've learned firsthand about addiction, about therapy, the flaws in Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as how recovery homes have failed, and also the research that they've encountered, especially the remarkable neuroscience research about addictions that explain what's going on in our heads. What you get out of Mike and Maureen's writing is a new way of looking and talking about addiction. It's so much easier, of course, to resent, blame, and shame the alcoholic. But there's obviously something else going on. I'll ask Mr. Pond about what he's been able to find out and what he does today in this journey of real recovery. It's horrifying when we learn that even our own doctors might not understand alcoholism enough to really help us. Maureen Palmer is an acclaimed filmmaker and former radio and television producer at the CBC. She's co-founder of Bountiful Films, which produced the recent Nature of Things film. I saw it online a few days ago on the CBC's site. It's excellent. Michael Pond has a private practice in Vancouver where he specializes in addiction treatment. His degrees in psychiatric nursing and social work were had from the University of Victoria and the University of British Columbia. This new book is published by Greystone Books. Visit addictionthenextstep.com. For more, please welcome back to the Plant Online program in person today, Mike Pond and Maureen Palmer. Ms. Palmer, good morning.
Hello.
And Mr. Pond, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in to do this. It's a pleasure to meet you both.
We're thrilled to be back.
Yeah.
So this book came out in May 2014, so nearly 2 years ago. Were you working on the film at the time that you were promoting the book? Or
no, what happened was we actually wrote the book, and somebody gave it to a friend who worked for The Nature of Things. I think that's how it happened. And at the same time, you know, Helen and I had been pitching various versions of an alcohol doc to both The Nature of Things and to Doc Zone, like alcoholism, character flaw, or chronic illness. And we always got turned down. And then I repitched this year with the very personal story that we could scaffold the science on. Yeah. We actually knew a lot more now because of our research with the book, and the CBC said yes.
It's a very powerful film. It's not without hope, obviously, because you know you both talk about what it's been like in this book, and we see in the film what's happened. But because I'd read the first edition, and so I knew the story, but to see it, it's something totally different, Mike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the filming was a very different process, actually. I found the writing of the book therapeutic.
Yeah,
you know, going through the narrative, and well, it's you know, like narrative therapy, really. And but the film, because we had to film in places that I hadn't been in a while, mm-hmm. and places where a lot of pretty traumatic and emotional and disturbing things happened. So to go back to those places and film and have to, you know, do takes and retakes and retakes, and it was a difficult process at times, very difficult.
What was more painful, going back to the downtown east side and seeing where you once were, or going back to where home was at one point, Penticton? And I mean, there's a scene there where you're driving past these motels that you spent a month here, a month mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. You can see in his eyes just you know, how to this day that obviously means a great deal.
Yeah, you know, the scenes downtown, the downtown east side, and in certain areas of Surrey in the recovery houses, they were, you know, they weren't pleasant. But yeah, to go back home and film in front of the house that we lived in for 16 years, and down where my offices were, and just to be in the town and the community and places that we would go where we'd have lots of fun, like at the beach. And so it was bringing up all these bad memories, but also these beautiful, wonderful memories, right, of really happy times. And so yeah, it was a bit of an emotional roller coaster for sure.
When we talked about a year and a half ago, Maureen, near the end of the interview, and I still remember this. I've done this hundreds and hundreds of times, but I still remember asking you this. In the course of writing this book, what you had learned about Mike that you probably didn't know before. And so now filming this and going to these places as you did and traveling around the world, I guess, with, as you were looking at all the research, these various universities and institutions that you went to visit, are you still learning about Mike?
You ask really good questions. Yeah, I'm learning a lot about Mike. I'm learning I admire him even more because I think the television was a very difficult process. And Helen and I, we actually thought a few times about stopping filming because going to these places was re-triggering. And he was so invested in getting a different message out about how you can get better that he insisted we keep going in spite of the fact that it was really hurtful to him. And I have grown to admire him even more. And I think, you know, he had to deal with me as a professional. And there was some real challenges there. But I think that he just keeps rolling with each new challenge. And I think a lot of what happened in the last year would have rolled over and put somebody back in permanent relapse, somebody stronger, somebody not as strong as Mike.
Yeah. And so I don't know in terms of if we're spoiling anything, but I mean, if you've seen the film, if you read the book, there was a relapse.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Mike, when you're in the midst of that, because we see this in the film, and we see how that affects Maureen, we read about it in Wasted, are you able, because you are a therapist, you've gone through this before, are you able to take the perspective while you're in the midst of all of this?
Yeah, most of the time I can. Most of the time I can step outside of it and
just see what's going on.
And just, you know, be an observer, so to speak. And I guess that's a skill or maybe just a natural ability that I have, probably from the work I do, to be able to be objective. But it was difficult, very difficult at times, because I could feel certain situations, certain triggers, right? But it was mostly, like I said, around home and when the children were little and those really beautiful, wonderful memories when they were little boys, you know,
before
my drinking mm-hmm. got, you know, really bad. Yeah. So.
But at the night of the actual relapse,
yeah.
Mike obviously wasn't actually well enough to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the next day, I think he was genuinely torn between, you know, we were learning all these new things, these new therapies, these new possibilities, but that drinking again, the recurrence, threw him back to a place where he got scared. He didn't even, like, all of these new things were not top of mind.
No.
He told me he wanted to move out.
The old Mike, you know, kind of, so to speak, you know, reared his head. And, you know, there was a lot that had gone on prior to the motorcycle accident. There had been some family stuff going on and some upsetting, disturbing stuff right from Christmas. So it was over a month and a half of dealing with some personal family issues. And that's not in the story. It's not in the book, and I won't get into the details.
Mm-hmm.
It's personal about my family. But so it culminated in the motorcycle accident and then ending up in Emerge. And we calculated I'd been in Emerge about 31 times over the few years when my drinking was really severe.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the times when I would hear the murmurings, right, from the doctors and nurses and, there he is again. What are you doing again here, Mr. Pond? You know that you just need to quit. And there's people in here that have real serious medical problems, you know. And
why are you wasting our time?
Why are you wasting your time? What are you doing here again in my ER? And it's a horrible, horrible place to be when you know that the people that are going to be hopefully taking care of you and treating mm-hmm. you don't like you very much.
Yeah.
Right? You're more of a pain in the butt than anything else. And so
by the time
I got home after that, you know, being treated there at the hospital and then home, and I just opened the fridge and, well, you see the scene.
Yeah.
I opened the fridge and now when I look back at it, it's just like a foggy dream
you
know, that I even did that.
So when this is all happening, Maureen, how do you react to something like this? I mean, you know, someone's instinct might be just to up and leave, but did you think that?
He actually thought he was going to get kicked out the next day when he
got up. I got
up
the next morning, and my brain was back to when this used to happen at home, and I was packing my bags and basically saying, I blew it again, you know, and now everybody knows, and they're all right. I'm a hopeless alcoholic, and I was getting too arrogant, I was getting too cocky, and I can't face this.
My brain split into two. Hmm. The filmmaker went, oh, geez, this is a really good moment. How are we going to capture it?
Yeah, good moment for all you guys.
What a pathetic freak I am, right? So I think, I've got two minds. Like, he's not well. We can't do anything tonight. We're having people over. Is this really happening? Like, within 5 minutes of me figuring it out, we had 20 people in the door. Mm-hmm. He went to bed, fortunately, very soon, because he had a big cut-up face.
Yeah.
A lot of people thought he wasn't well. Yeah. So most, except for one person, no one knew that night, right? Mm-hmm. And I just went, okay, well, we're going to have to document this. He went to bed. Everybody left. I pulled open the laptop. I started reading the transcripts, and I Googled Vivitrol, Bellingham, because we knew that this medication had a decent chance. And as you saw in the documentary, it had a way more than decent chance, because it turned out the Medical University of South Carolina took his blood and discovered that he has an allele, a genetic predisposition to do well on this drug.
Genetic variance, yeah. A mutation, actually.
So we, my brain didn't go into shaming him. We were also going to New York to learn this new craft therapy. My mind, I knew if I make him feel bad tomorrow, this will get worse.
Yeah.
So couldn't shame and blame.
So the way Maureen reacted to this is a hell of a lot different than those doctors in the emergency room reacted to it. So what I get out of this book now, rereading it a year or so later, is the way, and I touched on this in the introduction, our doctors don't know how to react to alcoholism, the way that alcoholics, their families, need to be treated.
That's right. It's probably one of the number one problems or barriers to this is that stigma is still very embedded, and it's a moral issue.
But it's a medical issue, and people are dying.
People are dying from it. It's unbelievable how many people are dying from it. And we've estimated from the experts that it ranges anywhere from 1% to 10%. Of the physicians prescribe the medication that they should be prescribing.
And we know that only 10% of people actually come forward for treatment because of the stigma and shame.
Yeah.
We have this situation where on the worst extreme, we have recovery homes where people with no choices end up. In the middle, you have a dramatically overloaded public system with huge wait lists and still based largely on 12-step, which we know only works for 30%. So you end up going back to these same programs over and over. And on the other hand, you have $30,000 to $50,000 a month private programs, also 90% predominantly 12-step. So we have a system, the vast majority of it, from extremely low-end to high-end, is 12-step, and it's not working for 70% of people. What does work is doctors actually treating this like the medical disorder that it is.
So then the question is, why isn't it being considered the way that it ought to be? I mean, is it just the lack of funding? Is it just the lack of will?
It's where the money is going. The money is going into corrections and prisons and those punitive rehabilitation corrections measures.
Yeah.
And that's not just in this country. I mean, it's all throughout the United States. And now there's certain parts of Europe, Portugal and Scandinavia, where it's a separate system that treats this. And they're having very, very positive results.
The Columbia University study, Closing the Gap, in 2012, estimated the cost to the U.S. alone, $700 billion. We are about $70 billion, we estimate now, for policy that doesn't work, which is still resulting in too many people dying and people not getting well for decades.
So I guess why AA has thrived is because it has thrived for as long as it has.
Yeah. I mean, it was the only gig, right? You know, 80 years ago when Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob started it, it was the only gig going. It was at the end of the temperance movement, and then it was the crash, right, the depression, and people were hungry for something. And so they had what people wanted, and it grew really fast, and I got a lot of high-power political support.
Yeah. You have judges, doctors, lawyers. Yeah. It became the go-to treatment, yeah. and it has become the go-to treatment in our culture, largely because there's nothing else.
Yeah.
But the irony is, AA could have evolved into something that could possibly serve more people if you read the original writings of Bill W., mm-hmm. because he wanted the organization to evolve. He actually said to the founders of Methadone, can you come up with something like this for people with alcohol problems? And now there has been this revolution in research, and because of the power that our culture has given to AA, it's so deeply entrenched, it's very difficult to get anything else to get acceptance.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the statistic a moment ago about the people that go to AA and the recovery rate out of that. I mean, did you say 30%?
Well, that's the high end.
Yeah. And that's being...
You read Lance Doty's, he says it's 5%.
Wow.
If you go to the CBC documentary page for Wasted, I put up all the resources for the facts that we used, and 30% is based on some of the world's best AA and addiction researchers. That's where we got that number. And they, even these people who are die-hard believers in AA, believe that some of the things that are endemic in the way AA approaches the problem actually contributes to the shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just reading a piece on the Huffington Post last night, and they were looking at all of these private treatment centers in Kentucky, of all places. And they were getting statistics, and the company that has about, I don't know, 20 treatment centers throughout the state was saying that we got a 79% success rate. Well, when they dug deep, what they found out was 75% of the people were either being kicked out or dropped out. And so who was left was the 25%. And so that's where they were getting their figures from.
Yeah.
They didn't even include, and then they said, well, who sets the guidelines and the rules for this? And they went, well, the treatment centers. Oh, so they set their own guidelines for how they're going to have be researched and how the numbers are going to be crunched.
Yeah, we talked a year and a half ago or so, almost 2 years ago, about your experience with the recovery homes, treatment homes, and just how terrible an experience that was for you and for a lot of people. I mean, there have been news reports and you know, award-winning news reports. I know CTV did a piece on that a couple of years ago. Is there any improvement in that sector of treatment?
No. I think, when it first came to a head, what was that, three years ago in Surrey, they went out and I think they shut down about 100 of them. But you know what, these places, once one goes down, there's another one around the corner, that's popping up again. And so I don't think there's anything really that's happened with it.
We see a need, and we're working with various groups now for a national strategy to battle addiction in Canada. And one of those things would be that you actually can't treat addiction without having the required credentials, and that every facility should have a medical person. Because these places, like where Mike was, you detox on a couch, a horrible couch for 10 days, you're prone to having a seizure. Well, you cut down a young man who hanged himself in the back.
Yeah.
These places cannot exist without medical supervision.
Yeah. I witnessed, guys having massive grand mal seizures, right on the floor. And
you also witnessed rampant drug taking.
Rampant drug taking. It was all around me. Yeah. I mean, if you want drugs, go to a recovery house.
Or a prison.
Or a prison. Yeah.
Another thing that reminds me in the book, and having read it a year and a half or so ago, just how the brain changes. And, I mean, this is what you see in the book and in the film, all this, these places that you went to around the world in terms of getting scanned, getting mm-hmm. research and blood tests and the sort. Have you noticed it? I mean, it's hard to notice our brains changing physically because they're inside us. But, I mean, what you saw?
Well, I saw my brain and felt my brain and experienced my brain over the 5.5 years of sobriety getting progressively better, right?
Hmm.
I had protracted alcohol withdrawal syndrome for at least 2, probably more like 3 years. So I don't believe my brain was even fully, just fully kind of working at capacity till about 5 years sobriety. I mean, that's unbelievable when you think about it.
Couldn't sleep, really.
No.
Sleep was a real challenge for the longest time.
Yeah.
But then when you saw your
and then
head.
when I saw the yeah. fMRI brain scan with the alcohol Q testing, it was like, my goodness, you know, my brain still gets excited, very excited, when it sees alcohol, and I'm not even consciously aware of it.
Yeah.
I mean, what's that tell you?
Yeah. And so when you get all the research that you've managed to gather through all of this, it changes how you proceed with your life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does it change your life at all, Maureen?
Yeah.
Your habits and the sort, does that yep. change?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask us this question, and, you know, so many people actually in some kind of mean emails from some diehard AA people accuse me of being an enabler and also sabotaging his success by having wine in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I don't have any wine in the house. And it's not because of those kinds of emails. It's because I saw that brain scan. And even though he's not aware, if there's wine in the house, is that a triggering thing for Mike? It might well be. He counters that by saying, honey, if I really want a glass of wine or a cooler, I'll go to the corner and get
yeah.
one. So we're of two minds. My feeling is, why would I want to not support his success in every way that I can?
However, you know, these cues can be very subtle and very abstract. And people think because, you know, I picked up that bottle of wine that was in the fridge door. I mean, that bottle of wine was in that fridge door for 5.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not the same bottle.
No.
But, you know, I could
once every couple of weeks it changed.
Yeah, I could have grabbed that bottle any damn time I wanted.
Yeah.
But it's all about the other stuff, right? You know, if my brain is already can be easily and readily excited by the thought of drinking alcohol, and then I'm in a negative emotional state, I'm really upset, I'm really disturbed, and we all know that when your brain is disturbed, the prefrontal cortex doesn't
consumes,
work very well.
Yeah,
yeah,
just consumes everything.
It just
everything.
Goes
yeah.
out the window, and you know, that's when... That's what I have to be aware of.
Yeah.
But I don't still get that, because in the 5 years together, there were many times where there was a lot of difficulty. There
yep.
were some real struggles as we rebuilt your life.
Yeah.
Way worse things than that period where you actually drank.
Yep.
And during those 5 years, still you didn't drink.
Yeah.
And you were upset lots of times, and you were fighting protracted withdrawal.
Yeah.
So I still think it's a puzzle, right?
Yeah.
On balance, I want him to be able to be safe, so I'm not going to have it in the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's fine, and I'm fine with that. You know, it doesn't bother me at all. There's many people that don't have alcohol in their houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah. Just because you don't drink at home doesn't mean you're a drunk, right?
We're,
no. Yeah.
And when I go out for dinner, we went out for mm-hmm. dinner for a dinner party last weekend, I had a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike's sitting beside me and everybody else around him.
Yeah.
And the host of the dinner party was so gracious, he even phoned and said, we could make this a dry event.
Yeah.
But you don't want people to do that.
No. Yeah. People to do that. I mean, goodness me.
So when you look at the research that you've gathered, and because you've been dealing with alcohol, do you know more about how our brains work in terms of other behaviors? I mean, mm-hmm. you buy too many books, maybe. Does that?
No. You know, it's interesting. These things that we do, like buy a lot of books,
yeah.
right? Or you know, are collectors, right?
Yeah.
People, I've worked with people that are obsessive about their collecting.
Yeah.
Hoarding.
Their collectibles, right? It's not even the hoarding, it's just that collecting thing, right? And it still goes to those same reward pleasure centers of the brain. just like a beautiful piece of chocolate cake or apple pie with ice cream or good sex. I mean, anything that goes to those centers of the brain has the potential to have an addictive quality to it.
Do I look like a hoarder? Do I look?
No, you don't. Right.
It's relatively tidy here, isn't it?
Yeah. Everything's neat, tidy. All the busts are kind of lined up nicely.
You know, there's some really interesting preventative work being done.
Yeah.
Even in Canada, a professor in Ottawa is working with kids who are really impulsive. And as you saw in the documentary, impulsivity really predisposes one to addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Helping these very impulsive children develop coping skills when they're 6, 7, and 8 has been proven to dramatically reduce the incidence of addiction 10 years later. So there's all kinds of things we can do as a society.
So you mentioned the treatment in Bellingham that Mike's... you're undergoing it, I guess. Is it monthly?
Yeah, I was getting Vivitrol injections. I had 5 injections over a 6-month period. And then I still take the gabapentin.
Uh-huh.
And I occasionally will take the naltrexone.
When
the naltrexone is the oral pill form of the Vivitrol. Right. So if I'm feeling kind of vulnerable or just, you know, I know now kind of what is going on, really, in terms of my feeling state and my thought processes and even how I'm feeling physically, that if I'm more at risk,
uh-huh.
You know, and so I'll take an naltrexone.
And you talk in the film about just how much this all costs. Mm-hmm. So do you see any improvement in how we in this country, in Canada, our healthcare system can support treatments like this in the future?
Yeah, I think we really can. We already do for all kinds of other diseases like Crohn's. People sometimes get a $1,500, is it a month or a week?
A week. Yeah.
And if we don't spend the money on these kinds of things, we are spending the money on prisons.
Yeah, yeah.
And there is a trial for Vivitrol underway right now at St. Paul's.
Uh-huh.
And there's hope that this drug will be widely available in populations in the States. For instance, people coming out of prison in Florida who are in for drug-related or alcohol-related offenses, they're given Vivitrol shots if they want them.
Yeah, and
for free.
In our government here, I guess they've started with smoking cessation products of a sort. So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, I think, as we like to say, the long arc of the universe bends towards justice.
Yeah.
I think it bends towards wisdom, too, as we develop public policy. And just from the people we've heard from, there's a critical mass of parents who have lost children and want the legacy to be that it stops. And these people are getting very agitated.
They're getting agitated. They're getting kind of like...
Organized.
Organized, you know, starting to behave like activists, right?
Yeah.
Because these are people's children, right, that are dying, you know.
Michael gets people in his office for who come in and ask for help. And what did that young guy say?
This one young guy, 26 years old, he finally went into his doctor and admitted an opiate heroin addiction. He'd been using since he was 19. And this doctor delivered this young man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so been treating him for 26 years. His response was, "I'm not comfortable treating addicts."
That's malpractice.
Yeah,
like we don't. They don't kick out anybody else.
So now, naltrexone has been approved, FDA approved for 20 years.
Yeah,
you should know, you know, about this, doc.
So how do you change the medical profession?
Well, we do a lot of agitating, and the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, great place, made 6 one-pagers on these drugs and have put them on their website. We put them on our website. We put them also on the companion site to the show, addictionthenextstep.com. And we talk a lot, and we are meeting with, for instance, the Canadian Mental Health Association. Doctors' groups are interested in talking to us. I think there's a new generation of doctors who want to change. I do.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old war horses that are a challenge.
Yeah,
it's sort of like sexism and bigotry. A generation has to go away before
somebody
things.
Is actually, you know, young doctors have said to us, this will change when they retire.
Yeah. When you did another point that I remember from our conversation in May of 2014 was this idea of abstinence and whether that is still a reasonable, I guess, goal or
Well, it's a reasonable goal for certain individuals.
I guess if you're under 18, that's probably the best thing, is it? Or
no, it's not so much an age factor. I mean, that is a factor.
But don't our genetics, in terms of how we develop, is in it? But like smoking,
if you get to 21, years of age without drinking, you've only got about a 5% chance of developing a serious alcohol problem. So yeah, that is one issue, but the main piece is what is normal?
Well, the thing is, it's Dr. Bill Miller said it so well in the film. You know, he did this wide survey of addiction treatment in America. 25% they consider totally abstinent. That's the success rate, right? But for the other 75%, he documented an 87% reduction in drinking, which in any other treatment of any other disorder would be unbelievable success as well, right? But because we only consider total abstinence the measure by which we consider success, we are looking at a whole population that we are shaming because they can't meet that. It's in that world, that's a population that's prone to picking up again because they can't attain that measure.
The problem is, as we said earlier, that only 10% of people that have a problem like this go and voluntarily seek for help. Okay, so why is that happening? Why is it only 10% are actively seeking help? Well, it's because of the shame and the stigma and being labeled an addict or an alcoholic. Nobody wants to do that. Because once you are labeled that, traditionally now, it's the only option is abstinence for the rest of your life and go to AA. And people just aren't very keen on that, apparently, right? It's a shameful and stigmatizing label. That's for one thing. So, and there's this binary kind of approach where you're either an alcoholic or you're not. So you're either sober or you're drunk, right? So there's this yes, no, on or off thing. And that's just not how it works. And that's why I like the new spectrum disorder.
Yeah.
So people that are in that mild to moderate range, very often in my practice, we'll find a way for them to develop a moderation management approach.
Yeah.
Right,
and it's usually not alcohol as well. There's other, mental illness, so maybe an addiction to drugs. You know, and it just it sort of covers everything up, and so that's why you only look at, say, sober or drunk, and not these other factors.
And that concurrent mental disorder issue, it's estimated 40% of people with an alcohol use disorder also suffer from a mental illness. That's the biggest reason alone that only doctors should be the entry point, I think, you know? And I'm not saying that there isn't a place for AA and Smart Recovery and Life Ring.
There is a place for that.
It's the camaraderie, it's the fellowship, as Mike experienced himself, not necessarily the steps. That's so vital to people getting well. But you need, especially when there's such a high coexistence of mental issues, mental health issues, we need serious medical help.
People getting kicked out of treatment for relapse, you see, there's a gain. That's because of that abstinence model, right? You're abstinent. Oh, you're in treatment. You drank again while in treatment. You're gone. You're out.
Yeah. Betty Ford no longer kicks people out for relapsing. They said, you know, what can we do better? How did we not? How did the program fail?
They reevaluate that person's treatment plan and customize it. Right.
Yeah, and that's a program, Betty Ford, that's 30, 40 years, and they've managed to evolve.
Yes,
and they are offering medications.
Yeah, the lesson through this book, the two editions of the book, and this film for me is just the idea of empathy, and that we need a language to talk about and talk with addiction, about addiction. I mean, that's something. I mean, you mentioned the emergency room experience. Those are medical professionals. But just on the street, on the bus. I mean, there's a certain way that people are talked to or talked down from that needs to change. So how?
This is my approach on the street, because especially in Vancouver, we have some real issues with street addiction. I often carry extra food, and I always try to smile and say hello if I don't have any money on me. And sometimes I give money. And you know, I've been out with friends and they say, why are you doing that? You're only perpetuating a problem. Well, I actually know that in some cases, if Mike hadn't gotten a drink when he needed it, he wouldn't have a seizure. So I think that we need to be a lot more compassionate to those people on the street because they are us. And if we can't do that, we can't do it for our fathers or our daughters. We have to, we who are, as they call them in AA, normies, mm-hmm. we are such a part of the problem if yeah. we don't change how we react to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, being willing to be open to, you know, hear the new research and the knowledge. And one of our goals is to change the conversation.
I think a key part of that problem is the media. I've worked in media for my whole life, and when we started pitching the book, friends, well, I can't have him on without somebody from AA. And I'm like, well, yes, you can. Yeah. Well, everybody knows AA is the go-to thing. How can you guys even criticize it? 2 or 3 years ago, we're writing the book, that's how I talked to Mike, right? Yeah. There is
I had to confront her. This is time to challenge the dominance of AA. And she looked at me like, no, we can't do that.
Deeply held belief in media that that's it. And you know why? Because media is full of drinkers. And a lot of people got help from AA. That's great. For the ones that didn't, we need help for them.
Yeah. And that's the majority of people out there.
It's the majority of people. Yeah.
It's such a pleasure to meet you both and to continue this conversation started a year or so ago. And I appreciate you coming in to do this. As I said, it's a pleasure to meet you both. And congratulations on the book and the film.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
it's our pleasure.
Now that we see where you are, we need to talk about this book addiction of yours.
I know a good therapist.
AddictionTheNextStep.com is the website. The book is called Wasted, An Alcoholic Therapist Fight for Recovery in a Flawed Treatment System. It's from Greystone. Do pick it up. It's a great read. And you'll learn a great deal from it. Maureen Palmer and Mike Pond join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.